Hi, this is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. On today's program, we reach back into the archives for an encore broadcast of our 2013 visit with one of the most accomplished and influential musicians of his generation, Pat Metheny. This is John Floridis. Welcome to Musicians Spotlight. We're very pleased to welcome Pat Metheny.
Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for making time to come by and talk shop with us here. Certainly very few listeners will need an introduction to you or your work. Without question, one of the most influential musicians across genres, but certainly in jazz in the last 40 years. Dozens of recordings in multiple formats, including, of course, the Pat Metheny Group, as well as all kinds of collaborations and also solo projects as well. 20 Grammy Awards, even more nominations, and countless other awards and honors. Pat's most recent recordings include Tap, 2003 collaboration with John Zorn, Unity Band in 2012, and What It's All About in 2011. I think where I wanted to start, Pat, was maybe just digging into the three most recent recordings, if I could, just real quick, and maybe just ask a question I'm sure you get a lot, is how do you kind of conceive of these multitude of projects that you're involved in and then find a way to balance them all out and then have the content be as high and the quality be as high as you have all these years?
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, you know, it's true. There's a wide range of ways of thinking about music represented in that batch of records that is really just kind of a direct result of you know, what I love about music. At the same time, I'm not really interested in sort of an eclecticism for the sake of it. I mean, mm-hmm. to me, there is a continuity also that I think, well, hopefully over, you know, 40 years or whatever, you know, most people can tell it's me pretty quickly. There seems to be some kind of a thing that connects all this stuff. And to me, that it's sort of the way all of those records fit together is the larger, more important message of whatever my thing is than any one particular part of it. I sort of feel like music is one big thing. I don't really think about, okay, well, this is jazz, mm-hmm. this is rock, this is pop, this is classical. To me, you know, music as it exists at this moment in time, it's much more common for me to find somebody who's a music fan who listens to Stravinsky and the Beatles and Beyonce and whatever, you know, as opposed to somebody like, man, all I listen to is, you know, Elliot Carter. That's mm-hmm. all I listen to all day long. You know, so I'm kind of like that in the sense that I grew up with records and radio and everything else. And it's been a very natural, organic thing for me as a musician to try to manifest a variety of sounds and or approaches to music throughout the course of my life. And those records kind of are a pretty good little, you know, specimen of of that output, I guess.
Well, you mentioned growing up with records, with the LPs. Kansas City, obviously, is mm-hmm. where you're from. I wanted to just kind of ask about what that scene was like, not just the music scene. I mean, I know you've spoken to that quite a bit in your other interviews, but also just generally growing up in Kansas City and how that influenced you as a musician and just as a person.
I was very lucky just through the chance of chronology and geography to wind up there at the time I did. I mean, Kansas City in the late 60s and early 70s was still a place where there was quite an active music scene, particularly in the area of music that I, you know, kind of was interested in. You know, there were a lot of organ trios, a lot of that kind of sound, and a certain kind of social platform that kind of music fit in perfectly with, you know, mm-hmm. and it just also happened that there were not many guitar players around Kansas City at that time. And I got a lot of great gigs as a 13, 14, 15, 16 year old kid by default that I probably should not have gotten, but I really ended up learning how to play from being around great musicians on the job. You know, besides that, I mean, I actually didn't grow up in Kansas City. I grew up in a place called Lee Summit that's about 30 miles outside of Kansas City. And at that time, it was far enough away that it was really a distinct other place. That's where my dad grew up and his dad grew up. And it was really like a farm town. So, you know, that sort of, you know, open space thing has mm-hmm. always been a big part mm-hmm. of everything for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of was lucky to have a certain proximity to Kansas City where there was this great scene, but also having grown up in a place where there was a lot of, you know, room for things to happen, I think aesthetically affected me a lot.
I was listening to an interview online, and maybe USA Today, and I loved this quote that you swing for the fences in your work. And I love the analogy, and this is in terms of audiences, in terms of when that music is fully going to be appreciated. Bright Size Life, initially, as you said, it sold like a nice 900 copies or something. Mm. And now it's recognized in the Smithsonian as a classic album.
Well, you know, I think that's true, you know, kind of across the board. You know, okay, we all have this incredible feeling for Charlie Parker, right? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, one of the great musicians of all time. But for sure, most of the people that, you know, let's say there's, I don't know, what, 10 million people on the planet who understand the importance of Charlie Parker. Of that 10 million, 9 million, you know, 800,000 of them were probably not on the planet at the time he was playing that. Mm. And while he was playing it, he was considered to be a great jazz musician. But I think it took some time for people to understand that this is one of the great thinkers of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I think often about Bach. You know, that's one that I think's almost indisputably, if not the greatest musician of in human history, one of the handful of the greatest musicians ever. So the guy's writing, you know, music for church services each week in Leipzig. Yeah. You know, how many people came back after the service and said, "Man, J.S.
Yeah.
Killing today, yeah, this week," right. you know,
maybe love that motif.
Yeah, maybe a couple, but yeah, right. Probably, you know, the majority of the congregation, you know, had abscessed teeth and, you know, whatever other problems they had that, you know, were much more important to them than, mm-hmm. you know, the amazing, you know, fugues and right. details that were, you know, laid out there by Bach. So, you know, and even he's an example of somebody that it was many, many years before even musicians sort of got hip to how mm-hmm. how much was happening there. Right. And I think that's kind of par for the course in a way. So my basic philosophy, and having experienced it a little bit now, as you described with Bright Size Life and other records, I don't worry too much about how things are perceived at the time, including the audience reaction while we're playing, you know. Mm-hmm. There's a way you can play where you can get people going woo-woo all night long and all that. You know, I'm not really that interested in that. I've never really been about that. I try to play good notes. And you know, I think a lot of times people don't even really notice it, you know, that much. Like, wow, that was a really good solo. You know, it seems like sometimes those ones, you know, I almost get no response, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have to say it works the other way, too. You know, it's like you can have a guy in the front row of a gig and he never claps for any tunes, and you know, he doesn't seem to be enjoying it. He's looking at his watch and you know, he's not really a participant in the, you know, anything. And then that'll be the guy that after the show comes back and says, "Change my life, man."
Yeah.
You know, and so you just, my thing is, you don't know. Mm-hmm. You do your best. You swing mm-hmm. for the fences, try right. to play the good notes, do what you believe in, that you feel strong about. And really, other than that, there's not much to say.
Well, again, referencing that same interview in regards to Bright Size Life, I love this part of the interview where you said the first eight notes of that recording kind of set the path for everything that followed.
Well, you know, I was very lucky at that time. I've had a lot of lucky things along the way. One of the luckiest was that I was sort of, I guess you could almost say, discovered to a certain degree by Gary Burton. Gary's band was my favorite band. I finally got the chance to play with him, and he finally hired me at the time I was about 18. And at that time, ECM Records was just starting. And right away, the guy that runs ECM, Manfred Eicher, offered me the chance to make a record. And Gary very effectively said, "Don't make a record. Wait. Mm. Wait until you are really ready to make that first record." And it was very good advice, because in that year, whatever my thing has sort of wound up being through the experience of playing night after night with Gary and everything else that was happening at the time really crystallized into something that it probably would not have been had I just jumped right on it at age 18 and not waited till I was, you know, 19 and a half or 20 or whatever it was. I mean, it, you know, at this point it doesn't seem like that long, but when right. you're 18,
exactly.
a year is
thing.
Like,
yeah.
you know, an eternity mm-hmm. to wait. But it was very good advice. And finally, I think that compositionally, what what I came up with that becomes the, you know, what the Bright Size Life record is about. You know, it's pretty robust in the sense that I can still play those tunes now, and sometimes do. There's a sort of valid platform there that is strong enough to still revisit after all this time for me. And that may not have been the case had I rushed into it a little bit more.
This is John Floridus. You're listening to Musicians Spotlight, and I'm speaking today with Pat Metheny. And Pat, I wanted to ask you about your general sense of melody. It occurs to me that in all the stuff that I've heard over all these years, there's such a strong sense of melody, and regardless of the format or the genre, obviously it's something that is so central to your work.
Well, to me, melody is kind of, you know, I mean, we all define music as harmony, melody, and rhythm. I mean, but melody is the one that is, of the three, that is absolutely the most mysterious and difficult to describe or quantify. I mean, you know, harmony, we can talk about chords, and this is a major chord, this is a minor chord, you know, this is a diminished chord, you add, you know, you stack four notes and you get these different kinds of relationships, and then you have inversions of those relationships. It's almost mathematical in nature. Rhythm, very similar. We can break down triplets, duplets. There's a lot of things you can talk about. Melody, like, where do you even begin to talk mm-hmm. about it? Where, how do you even describe what it is? For me, melody is something that is much more abstract than what it. There's a sort of almost cliche thing of the melody is this, you know, sing-songy thing. I think it's actually quite a bit more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. Because, for instance, Max Roach, a great drummer, is an unbelievably effective melodic soloist with there not being any changes in pitch in the overt way. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, for me to find a younger player who is a really good melodic player is almost impossible. It seems to be something that has very little interest to most players. Mm. I hear lots of young guys who can play all kinds of real fancy technical stuff and, you know, is unbelievably advanced harmonic stuff. But for me, the real telling thing about the way somebody plays is how they play a ballad. Also, melody for me has to do with, it's very closely related to development. And the whole thing of taking an idea and then letting it sort of unfold over a long period of time is something that is a real priority for me. And it seems to be something, it may have a little bit to do with our culture right now. I tend to hear musicians who are dealing in very short sound bites rather than long paragraphs and, you know, expansive, you know, like mm-hmm. connected ideas. And that for me, again, is something that I don't know, and I can't worry too much about how much people are perceiving that. But that's a big topic for me, is that thing of connectedness.
Pat, to follow up that discussion of melody, I wonder if some of that has to do with the fact that you're finding fewer and fewer younger players who are connecting with that, what you're looking for in melody. You've always had a real fondness and a respect for well-written pop songs. And I'm wondering if some of that has to do with, not to be like a couple of middle-aged guys going off here, but distinct melodies in popular music, which inundate us all around, it seems like it's harder and harder to find those for me. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that, you know, every era has a sound and a vibe and a feeling. This era right at the moment is absolutely about rhythm. No mm-hmm, question about mm-hmm. it. This is a rhythmic time. And in terms of groove, even though a lot of it is, you know, sort of not necessarily of human origin, but there is much more grooving going on now than there has ever been in human history. Mm-hmm. And solid grooving.
Yeah.
And interesting, fantastic new beats and new ways of thinking about rhythm. I mean, this is a kind of almost golden era of that. You know, my thing is, why are those things mutually exclusive? Mm. Why couldn't there be somebody who's dealing with melody and harmony, you know, right alongside with those things? Right. And some of it I do understand. There's a certain power of almost hypnotic effect that happens when rhythm is the prime motivation for a musical gesture. Mm. And, you know, that describes a lot of what's happening in the pop culture world right now. But, you know, I anticipate there being moments in the future where harmony and melody play an equal role in that. Mm-hmm. It's bound to happen.
Thank you. your own fondness and respect for well-written pop songs? You know, obviously you've recorded some of your solo recordings are specifically, you know, Norah Jones tunes and stuff like that, which goes back, you know, I would assume back to your beginnings. Where did that come from? And where, talk about that attraction to, you know, like a good pop melody.
Well, you know, I guess for me, I don't really think about pop, jazz, rock, country, folk, classical. To me, I think about music, mm-hmm. and the things that make good music are good, are the same, regardless. Yeah. You know, the rest of it is kind of a political discussion about, you know, like, okay, is this pop or is this rock or is this emo or is this, you know, I mean, you know, fill in the blank. I mean, you know, I'm not too interested in that aspect of it. I'm more interested in the kind of, you know, nuts and bolts of, okay, this kind of interval combined with this kind of chord adds up to, you know, X, you know, and you find those same kinds of connections, whether you're listening to Ravel or whether you're listening to the Beach Boys. I mean, there, you know, there's a lot of things that connect there. And for that matter, they can show up in odd ways too. You know, it could be, you know, a Paul Motion drum solo or something. I mean, it's like there are aspects of how music moves through time that are appealing to me, that you find kind of in a transcendent way to any kind of style. Mm-hmm. And that's what I look for.
We'll be back with more Musicians Spotlight and our encore broadcast from the archives featuring Pat Metheny. Welcome back to Musicians Spotlight and our visit with Pat Metheny. Pat, I wanted to ask you about your writing relationship with Lyle Mays. I like the part on your bio on your website where it compared you to both Lennon McCartney and Ellington Strayhorn. And I thought that seemed to speak to the scope of your music in a really nice way.
Well, Lyle's been great to play with for all these years. I mean, he's one of the few piano players that I've met who truly understands the guitar. And kind of vice versa. You know, I write almost everything on piano, and he's always been quite comfortable to pick up a guitar and play a part on the guitar too. So, you know, in that sense, you know, the writing that we've done over the years has very often been the kind of thing where we're able to understand the whole of it from both perspectives, and try to just get the best result. I mean, for me, he's been a fantastic collaborator also to help finish things, you know. That's the bulk of how we've worked together, is that I've written a whole bunch of stuff and then we get together and sort of finish them. We share a certain almost brutal honesty towards it, where, I mean, we're almost always talking about it. Like, it needs this, it has too much of that, it has that, you know, it seems like it wants, you know, that. And once it gets to that point where it's like, I've got a tune and it seems like we should finish it, it's very pragmatic in a way. And it's, you know, he's been a great partner in that respect.
A program host's indulgence, if I may. I want to ask you about a specific piece, and I know you probably get asked about this a lot, and which kind of lends itself to the question, are you going with me? The incredible evocative nature of this piece, it continues, you know, after all these years. And speaking of where you write from, I know that you wrote this from a synclavier, which at the time was not a whole lot of folks were writing from a synclavier. And so I know a little bit about that part of it, but I just wanted to know if you could speak to what's your take on how that has connected with so many people. I mean, if you ask a lot of folks, you know, what their favorite tunes are, a lot of times people are going to go to that. Myself, I can include it. And I have a very distinct memory of, if not the first time I heard it, but just a very pivotal moment in my life when that was playing the entire thing and looking out the window, and I just made a big life decision and realizing my life was never going to be the same, you know, and these kinds of connections that a lot of people have, and very specific to that tune.
Well, that's really nice to hear. I love that. I love hearing all those stories, and it's true. That tune, there's a couple of them, you know, over the years. Last Train Home is another one. Gets played a lot of funerals and so forth. A bunch of
gems you've gotten up there, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, births of children for Beyond the Missouri Sky, and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. I really enjoy that. I mean, Are You Going With Me is a tune, you know, that's one that's credited to both Lyle and I, but actually that's just me. It was improvised into the synclavier, and because this was such a radically new concept. I mean, it's almost laughable now. But at the time, to have a sequencer, you know, which is, you know, kind of like a recording sort of thing, but using, you know, the gestures of it rather than the sound of it, you know, this was 1980, and I had just gotten like one of the first 17 synclavs there were, and you couldn't do anything except play it, record. You couldn't edit it, you couldn't change anything. So, you know, the form of that tune, I wrote it up in Willow, New York, which is near Woodstock, and basically I played in the bump 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 part, and then I played in the bass line, and it was like, wow, I can play two parts, this is amazing. And I couldn't change it, and you know, that form, it just showed up. And then they had a button where you could transpose it up a half step. It's like, well, I can transpose it up a half step. And then I can transpose it up another half step, and it's not going to change pitch. You know, these things that are now so mundane that, I mean, you know, like, you know, any phone can do 10,000 times more than what that was. But, you know, sometimes a little thing like that can launch you into something that can be really great. Mm-hmm. And that tune, I have played it thousands of times now, and I feel like I could play it 24 hours a day.
Wow.
I never get tired of playing that tune. It's sort of the essence somehow of what my kinds of favorite things are, all in one place.
This is John Floridis. You're listening to Musician Spotlight, and I'm speaking today with Pat Metheny. Pat, I wanted to reference an interview I heard recently with Bob Edwards. I liked your analogy of talking about musical composition in terms of storytelling, because I've heard songwriters talk about that, but I haven't heard that many musicians who are known as instrumental composers use that same sort of analogy to storytelling. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I guess for me, that way of describing the character of somebody as an improviser was something that I heard from Kansas City musicians right from the beginning. In their opinion, the thing that separated an okay player from a really good player was their ability to tell a story. And, you know, the players that would often be listed in that respect would be like Stan Getz. Bird, of course, would be a great example of that. I mentioned Sonny Rollins before, but, you know, kind of on my instrument, I mean, Wes Montgomery, as much as everybody talks about Wes and the thumb and the octaves and all that, the main thing about Wes for me, and the reason he's my favorite by far, is, in fact, his ability to sort of unfold over time long, complex ideas in a narrative kind of way. Now, how this actually shows up. I mean, it's kind of an abstract concept. Okay, you're going to tell a story with melodies, with sound, with groove, and so forth as an improviser. What is that, you know? To me, there are certain characteristics that any kind of narrative exposition has, and it could even show up in a movie. It could show up in a conversation that you have with a friend. It could show up in many different ways, but there's a certain structural integrity in terms of the way something begins, the way it has a middle, and the way it has an end. And that may be over the course of a second, that may be over the course of 10 seconds, that may be over the course of a minute, that may be over the course of an entire album, that may be over the course of an entire tour, that might be in the course of a whole life, you know. That thing of sort of rendering time in a way that's comprehensible to some other human being, even in the form of an abstraction. To me, that's our business. That's our job, is to do that. And I feel very lucky to have been around a number of fantastic narrative-type improvisers, Gary Burton right at the top of the list, where night after night after night after night, I could stand right next to somebody doing it and going, okay, here it is, and then looking at me like, okay, now you solo. So, you know, it became for me a very literal kind of thing, like where you would feel it. You could sense like, okay, I need to connect this first thing that I play with the second thing I play, which then connects with the third thing I play, which then maybe references the first thing that I played. And at the same time, all the chords are flying by and the drummer is going crazy and all this stuff is going on. But under the hood of it all, there's a certain kind of structural narrative operation going on that I think allows people a sort of framework to grasp onto what you're trying to say. Thank you. I walk out on stage with the assumption that everybody in the audience is really hip and that they're going to be following all this stuff. Mm. And, you know, that's the thing, is to try to make those connections that have a lasting meaning.
I really like what you just said there, because I think a lot of musicians don't necessarily do that. Go in with the assumption that the audience is going to get it, or that they have, because what it speaks to me is the respect that you have for people, as who have come to hear your work. And I definitely get that vibe sometimes from musicians. They don't have that.
Yeah. I mean, it's, to me, the whole point of all of this is that, is to offer the best that you can offer to your fellow man, you know, in the form of music. The premise that people are fundamentally hip is one that I still maintain. Mm. It was a lot easier to maintain that premise pre-internet, I have to say. You know, it's, I was able to, you know, when you know, the feedback that you got was in the form of a letter or two that at the end of a tour or a record release, and you could sort of measure things off that. Now it's sort of like, you know, comment sections, as everybody knows, that's like the, you know, the worst example of human
humanity, you know,
humanity there is. And it's sort of like that's a little discouraging to think, wow, maybe people aren't quite as hip as I would like to hope that they are. Yeah. But nevertheless, you know, you still, you know, are surprised. Then you know, some person comes up after a gig and says like some mind-blowingly perceptive thing about the music from a complete non-musician's point of view. And it's like, yeah, okay, this is adding up.
This is John Floridus. You're listening to Musician Spotlight, and I'm speaking today with Pat Metheny. Pat, we began our visit talking about, you know, your initial recording, Bright Size Life, and this is one of those kind of breadth of career questions. I can't help but wonder, what does the version of Pat Metheny I'm sitting across the table from, what would he say to that guy who just put out his first recording, in terms of what to expect, what, you know, what that journey was going to be like?
It doesn't, you know, I don't, my perception of it is that it's a continuation of all of that. I don't feel like I'm removed from it to the point where I'll be able to do that. Because I do think there are musicians that look at their first record and go, oh my God, you know, what, that's so embarrassing and what was I thinking and all that. I mean, with me, there are no points along the way where I go, wow, you know, that, what was that? For the most part, I see it all as one long song. that began with that is not over yet. And it's all connected. You know, I guess I would have to be on another planet in a different dimension to really be able to do what you're talking about. Because I feel like I'm still in that. You know, it doesn't feel foreign to me, or, you know, like, wow, that's just, who is that? What is that? Right. That's still, I mean, you know, I could go out tonight and play Bright Side's Life from beginning to end. I wouldn't play it the same way, but the basic premise of what that is still, I'm still living that.
PatMatheny.com is the name of the website. It's a great website.
Oh, thank you.
Tremendous website. And you're very generous with your time in terms of answering very specific questions for folks.
I mean, I am about once every 3 years.
Generous?
I'm not. No, I don't. Honestly, I don't stay up on the website stuff that much, you know. But, you know, I enjoy the connection with people, you know. And I really appreciate the fact that people have allowed me the opportunity to be a musician and to, you know, come to the gigs and, you know, buy the records and support my thing, because that allows me to continue the research that I'm doing. And I really do appreciate that. So,
well, we really appreciate your time. I'm hoping that we get a chance to visit with you again down
the
road.
Me too. I love coming up here, and it's an incredible state that I've only been able to visit a few times over the years, and have really been enjoying our time here.
Great. Thank you. Well, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
You've You've been listening to Musicians Spotlight. I'm John Floridis. On this program, we featured an encore broadcast of our 2013 visit with Pat Metheny. If you'd like to contact us, you can do so through the Montana Public Radio website, mtpr.org, as well as through our own website, musicianspotlight.org. You can also find us online on Facebook and on Twitter. Our program is available as a podcast from those websites as well as through iTunes. Musicians Spotlight is a production of Montana Public Radio.